Hello, everyone. I'm glad you're with us today. And look, since I am preaching in digital form today, I want to mention our virtual online audience. Over several years, the number of people coming to our building to worship has grown significantly. I've mentioned that a few times. You've discovered that in the parking lot on some of our bigger Sundays, right? But each week, 1,800 people use 1,200 devices to worship with us online. And we expect to grow about 20% in our building this year, but we are currently up 26% online. Of course, we always invite and coax our local online worshipers to join us in person, but we realize many can't do it. So I want to acknowledge our online worshipers, those who tell others about us, and many of whom give financially and pray for our ministry. So if you are here in the building in the flesh today, will you applaud to say hello to the online crowd? Thank you. And friend, if you found us online, come and see us in person as soon as you can. Now, all of us realize the Bible implores us to love each other. But the Bible is realistic about the fact that some people are bad news. One of the best-known verses in the Bible reads, "Do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good character." Every culture, every generation has its version of this warning. The Apostle Paul wrote those words, but he likely heard them from his mom, like many of us did. And we've seen that warning play out in people's lives, haven't we? We've all seen a student or an adult strike up a friendship with a foolish person, and suddenly the quality of his or her decisions begins to plummet. So if there is not a sense in which you are watching out for people whose influence is questionable or outright negative, you are morally and spiritually vulnerable. When I was in junior high school, I was almost inseparable from a friend and classmate. We swam and learned acrobatic dives together at the swimming pool. We rode our bikes all over town. We played basketball. We went to church activities together. And to be fair, I often found ways to get into mischief without any help or influence from him. But as we transitioned into high school, my friend wanted to make alcohol a fixture when we were hanging out. He wanted to show up at girls' houses when he knew their parents weren't home. He wanted to model his behavior after his young adult brother, who was all about wild parties and wild women. And unsurprisingly, my friend began to have less interest in, less time for church. And I recall being challenged by my student pastor to recognize that I had a tough decision to make. I could insist on maintaining the level of friendship we'd had, with the likely result that I would compromise my character, or I could realize that the friendship had run its course and it was time for me to build some new relationships that would be better for my life and my faith. Have you ever come to that crossroads in a relationship? Friend, the Bible does not require us to trust people who are untrustworthy. We are to love them, we are to forgive them, we should not talk them down to make ourselves look better, even if some of what we say is true. But the Bible is full of sage advice on discerning people's character and protecting ourselves from the fallout that accompanies toxic people. When Peter told Jesus that he would not allow Jesus to go to the cross and die, Jesus knew that Peter's concern was well-intended. But he also knew that Peter's view was totally outside of God's will for him. So Jesus said to one of his best friends and closest followers, "Get away from me, Satan. You are a dangerous trap to me. You are seeing things merely from a human point of view, not from God's." In other words, Jesus did not confuse friendship with an obligation to take foolish advice from a friend. And I am confident Jesus wants you and me to evaluate the quality of our relationships morally and spiritually. The Bible encourages us to be on guard against people who are driven by money. And the first thing that instruction requires of us is to look within, to ensure we are not the people for whom others should be watching out. And if you're not certain what the honest answer to that question is, I want to pose a few questions to ask yourself for reflection. The first is, how much of my thought life revolves around money, possessions, and luxuries? Are you constantly daydreaming about new clothes, a new car, a new house, your next vacation, your next dinner out? Do you spend a lot of time thinking about fine wines and bourbons? Do you secretly desire an expensive upgrade to your appearance? Would you be tempted to end a current relationship if you could start another with someone who had more money? Do you struggle with envious thoughts of what other people have? Is your least favorite of the Ten Commandments this one? You must not covet your neighbor's house. You must not covet your neighbor's wife or anything else that belongs to your neighbor. Some of us use a lot of thoughts, noticing and longing for the lives of other people and the lives they are living. That's a sign that we are too focused on money and on things. Here's another question we can use to self-assess. Am I overly emotional about financial and material things? Friend, are you highly protective of your stuff and your money? Do you watch your accounts constantly? Do you easily become angry or worried when discussing money? Are you easily offended when your use of money is challenged in some way? Do you avoid church or make sarcastic comments when you know the teaching series will touch on money? Are you sorry you're here today? Does your demeanor go up and down based on your account balances? If your emotional state is tethered to your financial state, what does that say, friend? One more question to ask ourselves. Do I seek ways to be generous? Or do I avoid generosity? Two people with the same financial reality will often respond very differently to the same opportunity to be generous. In fact, sometimes those two people are married. She says, "I'd like for us to find a way to give to this need." And he thinks, "I would really like to avoid doing that." Generosity is often more about attitude than ability. Look at some words that Paul wrote to Timothy, a young minister he was mentoring. "People who long to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many foolish and harmful desires that plunge them into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And some people, craving money, have wandered from the true faith and pierced themselves with many sorrows." A lot of us have suspicions and opinions about rich people and their money. And we like to opine about what the wealthy should be doing with their money or not doing with their treasure. But this passage is not a warning to people who have money. It is a warning to people who desire money. The irony is that Paul does not even mention rich people. No, he directs these words to people who long to be rich, who love money, who crave money. He does not address them to people who have money. This warning is for money chasers. Being rich has ruined some people. Wanting to be rich has ruined many people. Now look, I'm not pretending that a lot of rich people would prefer to be poor. I mean, that's rarely the case, right? But the rich often possess more clarity on the limitations of wealth than those who are not already rich. Many wealthy people realize that a good life is a worthwhile goal, but the good life can be a mirage. John McAfee's last name is familiar to many of us. His antivirus software has run on many of our computers. He made a lot of money keeping our devices healthy. He also became disillusioned with wealth. Chris Martin of Coldplay George Foreman, the boxer and grill master. Comedians Jim Carrey and Russell Brand, they have all spoken of the severe limitations of wealth. Jim Carrey said, "I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see it is not the answer." The first thing we should do with this insight is to use it as a lens to look in the mirror. But the second thing we should do with it is to watch out for people who are skeptical of the mentality that some of these people have learned in their wisdom and experience. This verse we read a moment ago observed that those who crave money cause themselves a lot of pain, and they also cause others a lot of pain. Athlete Curt Schilling made a fortune playing professional baseball, but he lost $50 million in a failed business venture. And it was not only painful for him, but it was difficult for his family and for his business partners. The problem was not that Schilling wanted to keep growing and producing. The problem was that he risked far too much in the attempt to get more. He was keeping score with money, and his all-or-nothing venture came to nothing. The book of Acts records some key moments in the very early days of the church. Some of them are very inspiring. Some of them are very disturbing. In one scene in Acts chapter 5, a married couple sold a piece of property and donated some of the proceeds to the Jerusalem church. The couple had seen a man named Barnabas do the same thing, and apparently they noticed that Barnabas was praised by others in the church for his generosity. But Ananias and Sapphira, this married couple, could not quite bring themselves to give away all the proceeds from the sale of their property, so they gifted a portion of it to their church, which was absolutely fine, except they chose to tell people they gave 100% of the sale price to the church. Now, they did not have to sell the land. They were not required to give any part of the proceeds to their church, but they really wanted for people to honor them in the same way Barnabas was extolled for his gift. So they lied about the details to their church. They misrepresented the nature of their gift, and they spoiled their generosity with an immature, unnecessary lie. Well, God was so disgusted by their willingness to lie to their church about it, He ended their lives. They literally dropped dead. The husband was asked about it first, and he had the chance to say, "I'm sorry, I need a redo on this one. I don't know what got into me, but we kept some of the money from the sale of our property." But instead, he lied and then died. And next, the church leader spoke to his wife, and she did not know what had just happened to her husband. But she stuck to their story, and she fell to the floor dead herself. Now, this is obviously a serious event, but the Bible says the feet of the young men who carried out her husband's body were waiting outside the door when she was speaking to the church leaders. And that means they expected her to double down on the lie. How'd you like to be on that ministry team? Your friend asks, "Hey, where do you serve at church?" And your reply is, "Well, I'm on the lie and die team. We work closely with the funeral team. We've been really busy recently." You don't want that team to have to serve you. Obsessing over money is dangerous. It can plunge us into ruin, as it did Ananias and Sapphira. It is dangerous for us, and it is dangerous for those we influence. And that's why Paul describes the love of money as a trap in his letter to Timothy. Now, a trap captures someone who doesn't expect to be caught. When I need to set mouse traps at our house, they usually catch more of my fingers than they catch mice. I mean, that's just the nature of a trap. And the love of money has trapped many people in behaviors and circumstances they did not want. So guard your heart against loving money. Even if you don't have much money, you must be on guard for the love of money in your heart. And in the spirit of this series, watch out for people who are not guarding their hearts against an obsession with money, because they can do harm to themselves, and they can also do harm to you and others around them. I want to spend the rest of this message getting specific. What exactly should we watch out for in ourselves and other people? What are the indicators that we are obsessing over money, loving money too much? I can think of four indicators that something is amiss in my or your approach to money. One is questionable and secretive financial behavior. Being discreet about your finances is wise to a point. Everyone doesn't need to know your financial business. But when you begin to make financial moves that you have to work hard to keep secret, it is a warning sign, especially if your spouse or your business partners are the people from whom you are trying to keep information. So the next time you find yourself considering how to keep your finances hidden, stop and ask yourself why you are hiding information. And if someone in your life is being secretive or dodgy with financial information that should be available to you, view that as a concern. If you've ever watched a documentary about Bernie Madoff and his infamous Ponzi scheme, you know the entire floor of a Manhattan high-rise was reserved for all the nefarious activity related to keeping those dishonest financial transactions secret. Secrets were kept from investors, secrets were kept from regulators, secrets were kept from other employees who did not have access to that floor. Discretion is often wise. Secrets are usually unwise. Another sign that our view of money is wonky is constant conversation about money and material things. Now look, if you're experiencing a financial crisis, it stands to reason that you're going to have to focus on money more than usual. But if you never stop talking about how to make more money, how to get more money, what you want to spend money on, how much you long for more money, your words are telling you something about your heart. Never discussing money, never budgeting, never planning, never exploring, earning opportunities, that can be a form of financial neglect or financial laziness. But always needing to talk about money should be a troubling tendency if we observe it in ourselves or if we observe it in others. A third indicator that money is out of place in our lives or in the life of someone close to us is when financial priorities outrank spiritual priorities. If you think and talk more about money than you think and talk about your connection and your devotion to God, you are likely in the majority of people. But you should aspire to be in the minority of people who do not allow money to become more important to them than Jesus and his mission and his church. Jesus warned, "No one can serve two masters. For you will hate one and love the other. You will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and be enslaved to money." Now, a lot of people have learned through disappointment that thinking they can make something equal to God without it becoming more important than God is doable. Well, I'll focus on money, but I'll be careful not to let financial concerns completely replace spiritual priorities. Jesus said, that actually does not work. God wants the clear priority position in your life over everything else and everyone else. But here's the dirty little secret. Money wants that place in your heart and your life too. And money will compete for it. One final and important sign that money has become too important to us: when our people feel less important to us than our money. It is painful to come to the conclusion that your spouse, your parent, your child, your best friend loves money more than he or she loves you. And if you have people in your life who appear to be harboring disappointment because they sense that they rank below your expensive toys and your hobbies and your account balances, then friend, I urge you to hit pause in a big way and get some guidance for making a hard reset when it comes to the priorities of your life. Years ago, I read a book by Gordon MacDonald, one chapter of which has stayed with me for many years. And in it, MacDonald described two men who were in the final decade or so of their lives. One man had a lavish home and lots of digits on his bank statements, but his house was empty. His kids did not feel connected to him. His spouse had left after experiencing long-term neglect from him. The other man had a simple little home, dated furniture, a tiny closet with old clothes, and only enough income to get by. The wealthy man was full of regret, but he tried to comfort himself by thinking, I earned all of this. I own this stuff. It's mine. I've made something of myself, and I now belong to no one but me. The other man looked around his kitchen table and his living room at his kids and his grandkids, and he thought, these people own me. I belong to them. I am nothing without them. And then MacDonald asked a haunting question. What does it really mean to be wealthy? What does it really mean? The Bible teaches us to be rich in relationships, rich in good deeds, rich in spiritual priorities and treasure. So let's forget about your digits for a moment. Maybe you're rich, even though you live a humble life. And maybe you're poor, even though you have all the things. I suggest you spend the rest of your life building true wealth. Now, I want to give you three quick ways to take this teaching with you and to live it. The first is this: spend the rest of this year and next year defining true wealth and making a plan to pursue it. Friend, do not be satisfied with looking into the mirror and then walking away and forgetting what you're thinking in this moment, how you're thinking about shifting some things in your heart and life in this moment. The second thing is, determine to live well within your resources. Earn what you can, enjoy some of what you earn, but don't live beyond your means. Why? Because it creates stress and it tempts you to make financial decisions that will make you or make someone else miserable. Don't be the person that others need to watch out for, and be on the lookout for people that don't follow this advice. Finally, pray for a generous spirit and test your generosity muscles often. I've heard a lot of people testify to what they've learned about money, and the wisest ones all insist that the most satisfying thing they do with money is share it. The question is, do you have the strength to resist normal, which is spending nearly everything on yourself? And do you have the strength to adopt unusual, which is learning to love to give? Friend, I am not even talking about giving to this church today. That's really not the goal or the target of this message, not even on my radar. I'm talking about what activity will bring you the deep fulfillment and the peace and the joy that you really want in the deepest part of you.